This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Why sex crime victims stay silent so long. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Why did the woman accusing Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault wait for more than 30 years to tell her story?
On the healthcare front, new high-tech advances, giving infants a better shot at avoiding scores of illnesses.
In sports, it appears that in the NFL, you get what you pay for when it comes to kickers. Just ask the Vikings and Browns.
And the most disliked towing company in Chicago gets the boot from city officials.
So this tow company in Chicago has been infamous for a half a century for towing people who were parked legally, for not returning cars, for jacking up the tickets, and for sort of holding them as ransom, holding the cars as ransom, and for just being mean. They have a real reputation for being intimidating and mean.
Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin on how Lincoln Towing Service over the decades became known as the Lincoln Park Pirates. He's here later in the hour. After more than 30 years, Christine Blasey Ford has come forward to accuse Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. The two, according to lawmakers, were trying to get to Capitol Hill to testify. Things have changed this past week. One of the questions, though, among many about this development is, why do some women wait to speak up about things like this? Analysis from Dr. Elizabeth Primamore at the City University of New York. She's author of Shady Women, Three Short Plays, which details stories of women living in grief because they could not be their true selves. Elizabeth, help us understand.
Well, I think it takes a lot of courage for her to come out and tell her story. I mean, when I read her letter, I was impressed with it. Initially, I was made perhaps a little skeptical, only because Kavanaugh is 17 years old, and I certainly wouldn't want to be reminded of some of the things I did when I was 17.
Sure.
However, her letter is very powerful. She said something that I think is important. She said it is upsetting to discuss sexual assault and its repercussions. Yet I feel guilty and compelled as a citizen about the idea of not saying anything. And I think there that's the question. Women, in particular, have been in the past. There's been these cultural norms of silence for women, along with a sense of futility. If they speak up about their experiences, no one would listen, nor would they be believed. And I think that has always been the problem in terms of sexual misconduct.
Why is it that you think takes so long, I guess? Because part of me says, wouldn't you begin to repress that terrible moment in your life if that's what happened?
Why did it take so long? Well, I think because it's a sense of futility. Right? No one's going to care what I have to say. No one's going to believe me. And as a woman, traditionally, if a woman speaks up, expresses anger, she's been viewed as unfeminine or not a real woman. So now, which I think is very fortunate, women are speaking, being believed, and not giving in to these oppressive gender signifiers. And we're all seeing it. The female characters in my play My plays have defiant natures, complex moral dilemmas, which help, I think, help them not be silent nor play by the old rules. And that's what I think. The old rules are becoming near obsolete, and the power dynamic between men and women seems to be changing.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Primamore. She's an English professor at the City University of New York, also author of a book called Shady Women, Three Short Plays. And we're talking about why women wait to speak up about sexual assault. There's been criticism, as you've probably heard, about the therapist's role in all of this, and perhaps this was dragged out of her, you know, in some sort of at a political manner. Whether that's true or not, to me, you know, is not really the question here. But what about just yet another thing that women have to deal with when they come out?
Well, I think on the more positive side of that, the Me Too movement has emboldened women, and there's the power of building community there. You know, she's not coming out of the shadow, so to speak, on her own. She has a strong community of women supporting her. On the other hand, no one wants to be judged, and it's a very sensitive issue. So I think that's part of, and also, no one wants to be defined by an incident in their life. Including the justice.
Sure.
Nobody wants to be defined by an incident. Nobody wants to be defined, I should think, by a sexuality, by a race, by ethnicity. So I think that's part of the risk also. I think that's part of the reason for the hesitation in her coming out, and the problems. It's complicated.
The complications arise too when there are false accusations. Right? I mean, to go to the other end of the spectrum.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No. It's definitely a complicated issue. I mean, I certainly don't have all the answers to that, Gordon. But I guess we'll see what happens on Monday, but no, false accusations are a terrible thing also. But in terms of women, in terms of being subject to sexual misconduct, that has been going on for a very, very long time, and it's a sea change in our culture now that women are coming forward, and I think it's an important one.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Dr. Elizabeth Primamore. Again, the book is Shady Women, Three Short Plays. It's 13 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, glad you're with us. A wave of innovation in newborn care is giving infants a better start in life and could improve Americans' health far into the future. At the same time, researchers gaining new insights into genetic and environmental influences on the fetus, such as a mother's obesity or exposure to toxic substances, and a growing movement to provide better postpartum care aims to help all new mothers better care for themselves and thus their babies. Wall Street Journal freelance contributor Laura Landreau says all of which may not only improve health during pregnancy and infancy, but for years to come. Laura, explain.
Well, one of the things, you know, the March of Dimes, which you've probably all heard of, it's been around forever, they're funding these six prematurity research centers, including, you know, one at Stanford University. And so they're trying to identify the causes of premature birth. And one of the things they're finding is that you can go back to a blood test, a simple blood test, and that blood test will help you determine whether this particular mother is at risk of delivering a baby too early. And that baby, you know, obviously, if it's born early, is going to be at higher risk. So what they're trying to do is figure out, if we know this woman's at risk, let's figure out what we can do to prevent it, to slow it down. You know, they actually have certain drugs that can prevent women from delivering too early. However, those drugs, they don't always know who to give them to. Mm. And by the time the woman starts to deliver, it's too late to give them a drug because the baby's coming out. So that's one of the issues that that is very much in the forefront. Another thing that happens is that babies are born prematurely and their little brains can be injured. They might not have enough oxygen. They have lots of reasons that their lungs aren't fully working or their brains are a little more vulnerable. So even if you're a full-term baby, for example, this isn't just premature babies, even full-term babies can, you know, be deprived of oxygen and blood for just a few minutes. You know, they can end up with seizures, they can go on to develop cerebral palsy and other developmental problems. And then there's that risk of long-term problems from brain injury, yeah. Learning disabilities, there's a lot of evidence of this. So they're looking at ways to more carefully monitor those babies as the mothers are getting closer to birth and as they're born.
Mm. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal freelance contributor Laura Landreau. Her piece is called The New Improved World of Infant Care. She's got a look at the technology that is helping babies these days. In this story, too, you mentioned genetics and epigenetics.
Right,
what's the difference?
Right. Well, you know, genetics, we all know the full genome, people are getting, it's getting a lot easier and less expensive to sequence the entire genome of every person. And if you're a baby born now, you'll get a little blood test, it's the HEAL stick, and they screen for about 30 conditions. You know, things that are immediately of a risk, you know, problems with digesting milk or something like that. But what they're talking about doing now at places like, you know, Harvard-affiliated hospitals, the National Institutes of Health is funding this, and they are looking at how you could sequence the entire genome. It's called BabySeq, like baby S-E-Q. And they're exploring whether, is this the right thing to do? First of all, is this the right thing to do? Do parents want to know, what risks their baby might be or might not be at risk for down the road in the future? So they've got about 325 families, and basically they're randomizing them into just getting regular tests or getting the genome sequencing. And they're going to try to follow the kids till they're 18. And the idea is we're going to predict conditions, decide what medications we can use in the future. If we know you're at risk for heart disease, maybe we're going to go much more carefully into checking you every year. There's so many childhood onset diseases that can be caused by a single gene. So if you're aware of that, it doesn't mean that child's going to get it, but you know to watch for things. You know, the pediatrician knows, let's keep an eye on this baby. And, epigenetics is sort of, it's kind of one of those complicated scientific things. It's where something that influences the genes, DNA from the outside, and switches these genes on and off, it could tell you something about whether you're going to inherit a trait like obesity.
Wow.
So if there are weight control genes, could they switch those genes from obese to lean with changes that you could make in drugs or supplementing the diet or other therapies? If you know the genes are kind of going to predispose you through something, is there a way to fix that, to tinker a little bit with the genes? And obviously this is all in the future, but this is what researchers are looking at now.
I don't know if you've seen the pictures associated with your online story, but there's a picture of this Embrace MRI system at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
Yeah,
it's looks like it's just perfectly molded to hold an infant, in like a little silo to scan the brain, and a baby's like completely wrapped and swaddled and looks totally immobile and probably sleeping.
Yes, well, that's the thing. What they've found is that studies have shown that MRI images can really help look at babies' brains to see, first of all, has there been a brain injury, something you could never see from the outside, and the child might not have any outward signs of a brain injury. However, if you put them in an MRI, you can see that.
Thanks, Laura. It's Wall Street Journal freelance contributor Laura Landreau. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business. Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Do you have the guts to eat a piece of cake at work? Exploding rates of obesity and diabetes have some employers treating sugar like cigarettes. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Donuts or fruit? In many workplaces across the country, there's a battle going on between the health nuts and those with a sweet tooth. Rolf Winkler has taken a look at this office dilemma and joins us now. Rolf, aren't sugary treats pretty much an office staple?
Absolutely, and a lot of people think that's the problem.
What are some companies doing to get rid of sweets?
Oh, I don't think companies are doing anything very aggressive. Our story was mostly about people inside the office who are probably trying to use a little bit of soft power to remove the donuts, the cookies, the birthday cake that always seem to be around right in the middle of the office where it's very hard to walk past it. It's 3 o'clock. You didn't have a donut in the morning, but your willpower starts to break, and that's the time you might get a coffee and you're walking past the break room and, you just got to reach for the donut.
I was going to say, is it probably more of the leftovers just sitting around than actually sitting down and joining together and having cake?
Oh, probably. I think generally in most offices, it's hard to get a survey here, but I think in most offices, people bring treats and they sort of leave them in the center of the office, or they put them in the break room, or they just have them there for people to grab, which most people say, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. And a lot of those people are right. If you don't want to eat it, don't eat it. And other people say, at a certain point, it's like secondhand smoke. It's like cigarettes. Temptation is hard to resist, and I don't want to be exposed to your to secondhand temptation here.
It would have to be seriously a problem, though, for some people who are already struggling with their weight, no?
Well, that's just it. And it's funny, the reaction to my story breaks along a couple lines. There are some people who say, this is too politically correct. What are they going to come for next, my coffee? And then there's others that say, please get rid of it. But when you think about it, for the former, one thing to keep in mind is, it's not just a problem for people who overeat. It's also a financial problem for Everyone, if you do the math, in 2016 or 2017, the U.S. taxpayers each paid about $700 for obesity-related illnesses through Medicare and Medicaid. So that's if you paid taxes, $700 of your taxes, really more because the government is, of course, running a gigantic deficit, but you're paying about $700 a year to treat this.
We're speaking with Rolf Winkler of the Wall Street Journal. Are there actually companies, though, that are banning sweet treats?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of bosses somewhere who say, guys, please, please, just less of them. Don't put them here. We found a guy in L.A. who, it was funny. He had said, you know what, after the holidays, I think we've overdone the treats. Can we stop bringing them in? Can we stop doing the run down to the bakery every day to get the treats? And he says that actually ended. He thinks he broke it. He thinks he's the one who actually broke the sugar embargo inside his office.
Are there people that are trying to bring in better stuff, fruits or nuts or something, and is that going over well?
Oh, all the time. I think lots of people. I know in my office I try to sometimes, but I tell you, in my experience, at the Wall Street Journal, we like to celebrate when you get a story on page one. So typically the easy thing to do is buy a box of donuts because donuts are cheap. And, woe to the person who says, you know what, I'm going to bring in carrots and hummus, or I'm going to bring in bananas. There's going to be hell to pay.
Hummus and bananas. This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Rolf Winkler. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Look into any great business, whether it's a manufacturer or a hotel, a store, school, or hospital. Look into each and every one of them, and you'll find the same thing. Great people. At Kronos, we believe that great businesses are powered by great people. And with Kronos Workforce Solutions, we'll help you find them, keep them, and engage them. Learn more at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Behind the headlines, above the noise, you're listening to America's First News, This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, financial questions to ask yourself. Also, the most notorious towing company in Chicago, and what South Carolina churches are offering certain communion recipients. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. The player payroll of an NFL team is about $175 million, but many teams pay the place kicker on the roster roughly the league minimum salary, which is often less than $1 million a year. So what, you say, right? To most fans, seems like an easy job. Try telling that to the Minnesota Vikings or the Cleveland Browns, whose kickers at the time missed a combined 7 field goals and extra points last Sunday. More from New York Times sports writer Bill Pennington. Bill, how do you see it?
Yes, not all kickers are paid the same. I don't write headlines on my stories, but I think the headline that was written is pretty apt, and that said that when it comes to kickers, you get what you pay for. A lot of NFL teams really don't feel like they need to invest a lot of money in their kickers, even though they're the leading scorers on virtually every single team. I think they kind of think, well, one kicker is the same as another, but that's really not the truth. And if we didn't know that, we sure as heck know it now after watching those two games.
Yeah. Boy, I mean, these are September games. It's not like howling winds or driving snow sometime in November, December.
Absolutely. No, the conditions were perfect. It's just a matter of, I really think, and I've thought for a long time, that the NFL teams should give a little more attention to who they're signing as their place kickers. I mean, they make, in essence, 1/175th of the salary in most of those teams. And they spend more money and more time on a fifth linebacker than they do in the kicker. And the fifth linebacker is barely on the field and certainly doesn't hold the outcome of a game in his hands as often as a kicker does.
All right. We're speaking with Bill Pennington, sports writer at the New York Times. He's written a piece about Cleveland Browns kicker Zane Gonzalez and the Vikings kicker Daniel Carlson, who had dreadful weekends. And there is, as you point out, Dan Bailey, the former Cowboys kicker, twiddling his thumbs on a couch somewhere over the weekend, not working. You suspect that will change?
I do. I suspect he'll be in Minnesota pretty soon because they are a contender, and they probably are going to say, well, we can't keep putting up with this. I mean, you know, Carlson and Gonzalez aren't necessarily awful kickers. It's just sort of like a rookie in a baseball game. You really don't want – do you want them up with the bases loaded in the World Series, which is about how much pressure a lot of these NFL games come down to? But, you know, maybe they need to ease into it. So I do think Bailey will get a job in one of those two places. Minnesota would be the better opportunity. And they'll probably have to pay a couple million or $3 million to get him. I mean, the NFL is big business. That's a good investment. $2 to $3 million for one or two wins, absolutely.
Thanks, Bill. It's New York Times sports writer Bill Pennington. Since his story was written, by the way, Dan Bailey has, in fact, joined the Vikings. It is 22 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, you're unlikely to get the right answers unless you ask the right questions. That's especially true when it comes to managing money. We have answers thrust in our faces all the time, right? As marketers and salespeople try to get us to buy this mutual fund, that car, this stock, that home, certain insurance policy. But are these really what we want or need? That's the issue taken up by personal finance expert Jonathan Clements in his new book called From Here to Financial Happiness. He's also editor and founder of the website HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what questions?
From Here to Financial Happiness aims to take people on a 77-day journey that helps them to figure out where they stand, what they want to get from their financial life, and what steps they need to take in order to get there. And really, the first two steps are really important. You know, where do you stand? What do you want from your financial life? The latter in particular is very hard for people to figure out. I mean, we know tons of people end up with financial products they really shouldn't own. We know that tons of people pursue goals that really don't make them very happy at all. I mean, the statistics prove it out. Over the last four decades, the standard of living in the U.S. has more than doubled, and yet our reported level of happiness has not risen. Money has not bought happiness. It should have, but it hasn't. So one of my goals with the book is to help people figure out what it is they really want from their money so that they can then pursue the goals they really care about.
Wow. All right. So what are these questions then we should be asking ourselves?
So one of the questions I ask early on in the book, actually on day two, is if money were no object, what would you change about your life? Would you retire? Would you swap careers? Would you move somewhere else? You know, would you take foreign trips? What is it that you would change about your life if money was not an issue? And while, you know, as I say in the book, I can't promise to make all of these dreams come true.
Yeah.
Unless you know where you want to go, you're never going to get there.
Okay.
And we all know that we buy tons of stuff that doesn't make us happy. This is the reason people have basements. Basements are basically uncurated museums devoted to the purchases we made and now regret.
Fair enough. One of the things you tackle, too, is how much financial help should you give a child?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one because it goes towards our financial attitudes. I mean, many of us grow up rebelling against our parents, and then we end up doing exactly what they do. So I would bet good money that how you think about the help you provide to your children is somehow influenced by what your parents did. Either you're replicating what they're doing or you're rebelling against it. But I think that this is a really important question. It goes to your values, and it also goes to what you want to teach your kids about money. So, for instance, you know, a lot of people have heated debates about should you pay kids to do chores or not, or should chores be part of, you know, being a member of the family. You know, the kids get older, and it's like, should you pay for all their college costs, or should you make them work their way through college? You know, should they take out student loans? These are really big questions, and they influence not only your finances, but also the way that your kids will think about money.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com, and he's also written a new book called From Here to Financial Happiness, in which he examines questions we should be asking ourselves to figure out our financial lives. On a more serious note, too, question number 15, who depends on you financially, and how would they cope if you suffered an untimely demise? Explain that a little bit.
So if you're single, you know, if you drop dead tomorrow, you know, people might be very sad, but But nobody's going to suffer any financial consequences.
Okay.
Nobody depends on you financially. But, you know, if you've got a spouse and three kids, if you go under the bus tomorrow, you know, they may be left in the financial lurch. And probably, you know, if you don't have a substantial amount of savings, what you need is some low-cost term insurance to make sure that your family is able to make that transition after your death, so you might have enough life insurance to pay off the mortgage and get your family through the next couple of years and maybe cover college costs. So this is a really crucial question. You know, a lot of people focus on saving for the future. A lot of people focus on things like paying the bills and paying off the credit card debt. But having enough life insurance is probably, you know, the greatest gift that you can give to your family. Mm. But if you're going to do it, make sure you buy the right life insurance. So don't go and buy one of those extraordinarily expensive cash value life insurance policies. Instead, get a low-cost term insurance policy.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com. Again, his new book is called From Here to Financial Happiness. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. In a city known for gangsters, bootleggers, and corrupt politicians, residents will tell you the most reviled actor on the north side of Chicago is a tow truck company. Chicagoans for years have said Lincoln Towing Service, locally known as the Lincoln Park Pirates, has hauled away cars for no reason, overcharged motorists to get them back, and taunted owners who complained. Recently, a state commission revoked Lincoln's commercial vehicle relocator's license, and Chicago cheered. The story is by Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin, who's in the Windy City. This, Doug, sounds like no love loss here.
So this tow company in Chicago has been infamous for a half a century for towing people who were parked legally, for not returning cars, for jacking up the tickets, and for sort of holding them as ransom, holding the cars as ransom, and for just being mean. They have a real reputation for being intimidating and mean. So they have this long history of antipathy between the city and this tow company, and after a long investigation and the petition and a lot of screaming and yelling, they were finally shut down.
Boy, how come it took so long?
So the biggest question is, who are they paying off? That's what people are wondering in Chicago. Is there a, you know, how do they maintain their business license as long as they did? And the answer is, I don't really know. They've been in the spotlight for a long time. There are a lot of cars in Chicago. There's a lot of illegal parking. The attorney for the tow company says, you know, it's an infinitesimal number of cars that they have problems with, and a mountain has been made out of a molehill. Of course, the folks in Chicago do not agree with that.
Well, I mean, it seems from the stories within your piece that they knowingly took cars that were parked in legal spots and basically held them for ransom, knowing that people probably didn't have the time or energy to fight back or appeal or sue.
It looks like the modus operandi was they would get a contract with a private lot. The contract would expire or wouldn't have not started yet, and the tow truck company would still pull cars out of there, even though they didn't have a license to do it. And then there's just a tremendous amount of anger toward this company, because when people would come to get the cars, they would just get yelled at and hollered at, and they couldn't, you know, they passed a towing bill of rights because of this company, so that folks who had their cars towed could at least get into their cars and get their personal possessions out of them. And they could see the charges in writing, because there were problems on that score as well. But and there was a song that was written in 1972, which is famous in Chicago, called the Lincoln Park Pirates, because they were sort of looking at their shenanigans.
I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin. He's written a piece entitled "The Most Notorious Towing Company in Chicago, Maybe in America, Gets the Boot." Give an example of one of these folks you talked to and what they went through with this company.
A lot of what people talk about is getting screamed at by the tow truck drivers, getting coming in to pay the tickets, complaining that they were towed illegally, that they shouldn't have been towed, and people telling them when they get there, in very vulgar and foul language, that's not their problem, and they had to pay $250 to get the car back, and that was the end of that. And then, you know, in order to get to appeal this, you'd have to go to a hearing, and you probably would have to go twice, and it's $200, so it's, you know, it's not nothing, but it's you want to take a day or 2 days off of work to make that happen. The answer is probably not. So I think what ultimately happened is social media caught up with them. People were able to connect with each other, maybe 5 years ago, and start to sort of realize that this is happening to everybody, and get together. And then one of the aldermen sort of took the bull by the horns and started to drive the message a little bit.
Nice, Doug. Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Belkin. He tells a story, by the way, of Abby Amy, who was 6 months pregnant in 2014, and the wind chill was minus 40. Lincoln had towed her car from a space that she leased. After she presented her lease, she said the man behind the bars yelled, "You're a drunk." She spent 2 years pursuing the case and won $2,000 in damages in civil court. Lincoln sounds like it takes its customer service cues from the airline industry. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Only 3% of the 170 worshipers at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, need special bread for Holy Communion. But the Reverend Adam Shoemaker, who serves as rector, said it's not about the numbers. The Post and Courier says St. Stephen's is one of several local churches that offer gluten-free bread during the Holy Eucharist to accommodate parishioners with celiac disease and other sensitivities. Historically, many churches have kept with tradition and served wine and wheat-only bread, which contains gluten, a protein found commonly in wheat. But today, some churches offer bread without gluten. At St. Stephen's, roughly 170 members participate in communion with around 5 who need gluten-free wafers. Those pieces of bread, by the way, are placed on a separate plate from the wheat bread. Some churches also have substituted wine to accommodate parishioners. Several Baptist, Methodist, and other congregations across this region in South Carolina offer grape juice and water instead. For Jennifer Kashenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.